So good evening. This is, I've lost track, fifth or sixth or something in there. This is a series of classes where we're starting our study of chapter 9. So we haven't made it all that far, but I think we've again made some progress in terms of our understanding, I hope, of these rather complex teachings. So last time we made it up through, we completed the section that had to do with dispelling the objections in regard to, first there was the presentation of the two truths, of the ultimate truth and conventional truth as it's understood in this school. Shantideva will go on to explain ultimate truth in greater detail, how we realize emptiness and what emptiness is. But there's already some objections that came up. Those were in verses, the first part of it was the actual verses 4, that latter part of 4, and the verse 5. And then there was a whole series of things, verses 6 through 15 AB that we went through last time, that had to do with kind of beginning with those people in the Buddhist schools who propound that things have true existence. So it's kind of like Prasangika has sort of crossed a border when they've gone this far in terms of what they're negating. And they've put all the other Buddhist schools that precede them that we studied in the tenets class kind of on the defense, because they don't see how reality can function, how things can exist if they don't have true existence. And certainly if we examine our own understanding of emptiness, we might have this dilemma as well, kind of falling into this extreme of nihilism, thinking that if things lack true existence, there's no way that they can possibly exist, that they can't function. How do things occur? You know, how do Buddhas, how do we generate merit towards Buddhahood and all this if there is no truly existent merit, no truly existent actions, no truly existent person, nothing with any sort of true existence whatsoever, how does the world function? And so we went through dispelling those initial objections. Now we're going to move into, and we did a little bit, just the very first verse of this section, where we looked at the specific debate that comes up around the mind-only school, which again is the other Mahayana tenet system. The Madhyamaka obviously is divided into Svatantrika and Prasangika. We went through that in the tenets class. But at this point, it's primarily the mind-only school that's coming up with some refutation. Shantideva is very skillfully putting this in here to try to encourage anyone who's still holding on to these mind-only views to come to the Madhyamaka point of view, the Prasangika Madhyamaka point of view, by beginning to sort of poke holes in their objections, the things that they're going to object to. Because again, recall from our studies of the mind-only school that they have a very, very different way of positing emptiness. They say, again, that there's these imprints or bakchaks that are planted, or if you will, sort of imprinted within the mind basis of all. They even add another level of consciousness. From this consciousness, these seeds spring forth and arise in the nature of both an experience of the subject as well as the object that's being experienced. So they say that everything that we experience in the external world, although it has an illusion of being external to our consciousness, is actually not distinct from our consciousness. It's arising from that same seed. So it's a very hard, I find mind only a very hard school to get my head around in terms of a real understanding of what they're saying. And we're going to get into some of that with some of these verses that where they bring up their objections, and we try to really nail down Chittimatra school as to what they mean by saying that things don't have an external existence. And in the process, we're also going to, of course, this is how they refer to, this is the major problem we have with how they talk about objects, is that they lack external existence. The Prasangika school says no problem with external existence. This is external to the mind. This is external to the mind. You're all external to my mind. It's not a problem. The other side of what Chittimatra is doing, though, is holding on to the true existence of consciousness, saying consciousness has inherent existence, reifying consciousness to a great degree, if you will. And Prasangika takes great objection to that. So these are the two main points that we're going to see as we go into this school, these verses starting with 15 CD that we went through last time. I think we actually even covered the first part of 16AB, but any questions on kind of context, where we're at with this, what Shantideva's doing, and yeah, Janice.
For the mind only is establishing their inherent existence of these objects on the basis that they're on the basis of their belief that the consciousness is their consciousness.
You know, that's a hard point to get at too, is you know, they kind of point, Prasangika points to some holes in their thinking as well. They say an external object doesn't exist as external to the mind, and yet it does have inherent existence. It does have true existence. It really does, and Prasangika is going to say basically that you've got some problems in how you're positing that, because if things don't exist the way that they appear, and we already touched on that the last time we were together in that initial passage, then if they don't exist the way that they appear, then they don't exist inherently either. You know, you can't say that there's an illusion going on, but the illusion only goes so far, and then there is something concrete there that's reliable and you know, something you can count on that's underneath that. So although Chittamatra certainly does say all phenomena that, well, not all phenomena, but the categories of phenomena that have been delineated in the third wheel turning of the Buddha exist truly, and external objects do exist truly, they mainly take offense at mind only holding that the mind exists inherently, because this is something that they really have to undermine. They've already begun to, Chittamatra's already somewhat undermined some of their adherence to external objects, although they might still be holding them to be inherently existent. If you, again, really poke holes in it, I think that they would certainly say that that would probably be something they could let go, but they really can't let go of there being inherently existent consciousness. The mind has some sort of reified status that they have to hold on to, because otherwise the whole thing falls apart in terms of how things come into existence, this whole appearance of external objects and all that. So in terms of answering your question, Janice, I'm not really absolutely sure how a Chittamatran, if we had one in the room, you know, and said, okay, how do you posit the way that things exist external to you, would they really go so far as to say that things, although they don't exist external to the mind, that they do have some inherent or true existence? A lot of, I mean, this is something that we said to a degree when we studied tenets, is that these are always kind of the Prasangika, Madhyamika point of view looking back at all these other schools. And to some degree, though again, I don't want to make that as a across-the-board statement at all, putting words in their mouth to some degree in terms of what their actual view is, I think you'd almost have to have one of these tenet holders in the room and really pick them apart and find out what they're actually holding. So that's why, again, the main points of view that Shantideva emphasizes and that Chandrakirti in his Madhyamaka Vatara emphasizes as well is saying that external objects do exist, which, you know, as external to the mind, which the Chittamatra school holds to, you know, that they don't exist external to the mind, and then that consciousness lacks inherent existence, which is, again, they are holding that consciousness has to have inherent existence. Mm-hmm. Kimberly.
So are there Chittamatran folks around, and they have monasteries and stuff? Is this historic, or and they're all?
You know, it's historic, but at the same time, I do get the impression from things I hear about Chan Buddhism, Zen Buddhism, that there are some of the tenets of Chittamatra incorporated into that. But I've never studied those systems, and I couldn't tell you for sure that that's, you know, and whether they're pure in terms of this point of view looking back at mind only, whether they're holding tenets to that degree, I couldn't really tell you that either. I think that that's probably not going to be found intact as a whole system in the way that Prasangika Madhyamika is practiced as a system within Tibetan Buddhism. And if anyone else knows anything different than that, you're welcome to share it. But I do see things. Like, even, for example, I read Thich Nhat Hanh's book on the Heart Sutra. It's called The Heart of Understanding. And there's all sorts of stuff in there that sound really Chittamatra. You know, so I would encourage you, be somewhat discerning when you do look at, you know, commentaries on emptiness and on these teachings by Zen Buddhist or Chan Buddhism, you know, these schools, because what they're saying, again, may not really accord with what you're hearing in here. So it's not to say that don't read them, but just be mindful. And it's actually said within Tantra that you can go pretty far with a Chittamatran point of view. It's not like we're completely throwing Chittamatran out, but at some point, in order to actually remove ignorance, fundamental ignorance, you have to move to the Prasangika point of view, according to everything that Tibetan teachers say. His Holiness the Dalai Lama says this quite clearly.
And there's four schools of Tibetan Buddhism.
Yeah, the four schools of Tibetan Buddhism are more related to lineages and particular practices that are emphasized within those lineages. All four of those schools consider themselves to be Prasangika Madhyamika in terms of tenets.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, how they interpret Prasangika Madhyamika tenets is always going to be slightly different. Lama Tsongkhapa has his own approach that is very Gelugpa and that Kagyu schools and other schools have taken some issue with. And so again, you might even see when you're reading a Kagyu treatise on emptiness or a teaching on emptiness, it might be slightly different. The way Pema Chodron talks about emptiness is going to be got a different flavor to it than the way that a Gelugpa would talk about emptiness. And again, I'm not discouraging you to pursue these. Just be mindful that you're going to hear different things. Oftentimes in our studies over in Italy, they would say that that in the monasteries, they tell the monks, get one point of view down first before you start reading different commentaries from different points of view. And you know, because it becomes very confusing if all of a sudden, you know, you're reading something, it's really coming from another point of view. And so, again, I think I could give that same advice. Certainly have great conviction, not from having realized emptiness, but from understanding these teachings the way that I do, that this is the final view of the Buddha. However, you all need to figure that out for yourself and pursue that yourself. That's part of our, you know, why tenets is taught, is because we need to come to that understanding through examining these various schools of thought. You know. So that's also part of, again, why we're, Shantideva's bringing this all in, you know, is some desire to help us to, you know, figure that out for ourselves. Do these views hold water? Do these views, you know, hold up under reasoned analysis? Which is really what it comes down to in the end. You know, if we can't actually sit and analyze and figure out emptiness for ourselves, there's no point. You know, we have to be able to get to that point of view ourselves through our own reasoning. So, let's go ahead and start with, everyone has a copy of the text now then, I think, to refer to. On page 225, we'll, maybe what we'll do is just go back and review real quickly the verse that we started with. So I think, again, we went through 15 CD and 16 AB, so let's read these two together. If even a mistaken consciousness does not exist, then what will observe the illusion? If the illusion itself does not exist for you, then what is observed at that time? So again, in your commentary, which is on page 226 at the bottom, this is the commentary on these two, the mind-only proponent 15 CD. The idea here is that mind-only is still holding to this idea, though, that if all phenomena lack inherent existence, then if even a mistaken consciousness holding to an illusion, which is how they posit, what they're saying, you know, both Chittamatra and Madhyamika have this idea that there is a consciousness that's mistaken with regard to what's going on. You know, in Chittamatra, it's that things have an existence external to the mind. In Madhyamika, it's that they have an inherent existence. But because of their adherence to this idea that inherent existence means it can't exist, they can't possibly fathom how you can have a mistaken consciousness that exists if it doesn't inherently exist. So once we've established that the Madhyamika point of view is that all phenomena lack inherent existence, mind only very quickly says, you mean even the consciousness lacks inherent existence? If the consciousness lacks inherent existence, then there are no mistaken consciousnesses, because there's no consciousness. There can't be a consciousness if there is no inherently existing consciousness. So as I said, this is one of the main points of view that Shantideva is going to poke holes in, is their strong adherence to an inherently existing consciousness. that mind has to have inherent existence. So they're asking here, if even a mistaken consciousness holding to an illusion does not exist, why? Because it does not inherently exist, then what mind observes that illusion? You know, you're telling us Madhyamika about an illusion as well. Where is this mistaken consciousness if it doesn't inherently exist? So then the middle way proponent is, you know, once again reiterating what I just said. This is a dispute in which you think that if this exists, then it must exist inherently. If it doesn't exist inherently, it can't possibly exist. So there, even though we've already gone through some of this refutation of this point of view of inherent existence not equaling existence, that these are two separate things. We can negate inherent existence and still retain existence at a nominal level, albeit, but still existence. So they're already kind of pinpointing mind-only's problem, that they're still adhering to this idea that equating inherent existence and existence. So if the appearance of the apprehended object as an external object, which is mind-only's point of view, that they're dealing with this idea of this object appearing as external to the mind. If that's established just as it appears, you know, and we say to mind only, okay, let's let go of what you say that it isn't an external object. Let's say it is established that way. Then, since they exist as external to the mind, you know, then there is no illusion going on for you either. You know, so. And this is, again, what Prasangika holds, is that there are external objects, objects that are external to the mind. But anyway, they're saying there's only two choices. Either what you say is the illusion, that things exist external to the mind, exists that way, or it doesn't exist that way. So first, if it does exist that way, then forget it. You don't even have any ground to stand on, mind only. Your whole concept of this being what the illusion is about is a fallacy. Then at the latter part of it says, if it is not established just as it appears, which is what mind only holds, then since it lacks inherent existence, which is what we were talking about earlier, Janice and I, in terms of this question of how can they possibly say this doesn't exist as an object external to the mind, but it exists inherently or truly. According to Prasangika, this is totally ridiculous. If this doesn't exist external to the mind, it doesn't have inherent existence. These are hard concepts to get our head around, I admit. You know, this idea of this illusion going on, if this is an illusion that this is an external object, and instead this object is arising from some seed planted on our consciousness that's giving rise to that, then it really doesn't have its own sort of objective existence. They're not saying, again, we're going to get into this in some of these other verses, Chittamatra isn't saying that this is mind. You know, they're not saying at that level that this is mine, but they're saying that this arises from the same karmic potential, this bakchak or imprint on the consciousness that gives rise to the mind, knowing it and the object itself at the same time. It's like, you know, this whole illusion that's going on that there is some sort of external object when it's actually arising from the same seed as the mind knowing it. So in that way, they're kind of the same substance. But it does have, for Chittamatra, its own sort of entity, if you will. Albeit an entity that is completely dependent upon the mind. No. It doesn't. It's not that which is clear and knowing, which is consciousness. So we're definitely not equating it to mind. But at the level where we're denying its external existence, according to Prasangika, you've got to be denying its inherent existence too. So, whether, again, we can toy with that in our, you know, outside of class or whatever, but if you do analyze, according to what Prasangika says, you find that this negating of external existence, existence external to the mind, would by ipso facto negate inherent existence as well. There's no way you could have a truly existent or inherently existent object if it doesn't exist external to the mind. Now again, according to Prasangika, you don't have that anyway, but they're just poking holes in the mind-only point of view. So, let's go back to what is being said in this commentary. If it is not established just as it appears, in other words, it is not an external object to the mind, then it would also lack inherent existence, and therefore, It would be utterly non-existent according to your own logic, mind only, because you just said if it's not inherently existent, it doesn't exist. So if it isn't inherently existent, then guess what? There's no object at all. There's nothing that even appears as an external object. The whole illusion falls apart. So that's why in this verse it says, what object then is there? What illusion is there? You know, you may poke holes in what, from your point of view, in what we're saying in terms of the consciousness not being inherently existent, but even your whole view of the way the illusion's going on doesn't hold water. Because if it is the illusion that you say it is, then this would lack inherent existence as well as external existence. And therefore, according to your own logic, it wouldn't exist. Because if it doesn't have inherent existence, it doesn't exist. Did I make that clear? I know these are really like, kind of have to keep turning corners and holding on to what you were holding on to before. Questions? So then he concludes by saying, if even the illusion-like appearance as the apprehended object itself does not exist, then what apprehended object is observed at that time? So this is just the conclusion of that in terms of, you know, if you don't have that going on in terms of there's no inherently existent object, therefore there's no object, then there's no apprehended object to be observed. Apprehenders of form, sounds, and so forth will not exist then as well. You can't have consciousness as observing these objects if the objects don't exist. So it's basically just kind of throwing consequences back at mind only for their refutation of this point of view of equating inherent existence and existence.
Can you say that sentence you said
back again? Okay. If there is no... So if we've refuted that this... there. If we've refuted that there's that this point of view, let's say okay again that the mind-only point of view is correct. This is not an object external to the mind. According to Prasangika, that would imply that it's also then not inherently existent, which would then turn back to the mind-only point of view that if it is lacking inherent existence, it lacks existence. There's nothing that exists if it's not inherently existent. Therefore, there's no apprehended object. I can't even like apprehend this. And there's no consciousness that's apprehending it. Okay? So there's like, their whole schema falls apart in the face of this consequence of if it lacks existence external to the mind, according to what Chittamatra is saying, then according to what Prasangika is saying, it would lack inherent existence. Now again, we have to work with that, and maybe we'll find some time to get into that in a little bit more detail, but this is something that, again, is keep point that Shantideva is raising, is that if they're going to negate external existence, they have to negate inherent existence of those objects. This is inconsistent for them to be doing that. Okay. Let's move on a little bit. So again, that next section where it starts at the top of page 227 is going to be related to 16 CD. And then the reply from Middle Way is related to 17 and 18 AB. So let's read first the point of view from mind only. This is the last two lines of 16 on page 225. If the other exists as those aspects are just mind. Okay. So let's read what the commentary says on page 227. The top there where it says mind-only proponent. Even if the objects that are just as they appear, appearing as external objects, do not exist as those. Okay, so, you know, mind-only is saying, you know, we're going to adhere to our point of view, that objects that appear as external objects don't exist as external objects. That other than them exists. Those aspects of forms and so forth are just of the substance of mind. So this is kind of getting into a little bit more detail about what mind only is saying about this illusion that's going on. So again, this is arising from a seed on my mind basis of all that gives rise to my consciousness, my eye consciousness observing it, as well as its appearance. What they're saying is it's the same substance of the mind, but yet, as it says in this commentary, it is other than the mind. So it's kind of like this idea of, it's different than mine, but it's the same substance as the mine. Which Prasangika, of course, is going to say, well, you know, you're talking out of both sides of your mouth, basically. Let's read the reply, and then maybe, again, this will make a little bit more sense when we go back and kind of understand how my middle way is kind of looking at this. Let's read verse 17 and then 18 AB. If mind itself is an illusion, then what is seen by what at that time? The protector of the world also taught, mind does not see mind. Just as the blade of a sword does not cut itself, the mind is similar. Okay, so. So the middle way proponent is, if we go to the commentary that's on page 227, begins by saying, if mind itself appears as an illusory object, because this is the idea that Chittamatra seems to be saying, okay? If we say that this external object, this is a same substance as the mind, then in effect, some aspect or part of the mind is appearing as that object, okay? So if mind itself appears as an illusory object, okay, but there is no external object, meaning an object external to the mind, then what consciousness that is free of an object is seen by what valid cognizer at that time? So the idea here is that since the mind and the object are the same substance, who is seeing what is seen? If they're the same substance, then you basically have mind involved in both of them. You have this object that has this appearance of being external that's the same substance as the mind that's observing the object. According to Prasangika's point of view, this is really kind of absurd that you've got mind observing mind. If that's what the illusion is that's going on, if this is the same substance as the mind, then in effect, mind is observing mind. Which for Chittamatra, again, is not going to be a problem. They're going to posit that there's self-cognition, which we talked about in the tenet system of Chittamatra, as well as some of the other tenet systems. They adhere to this view that there is a self-cognizer. There's some aspect of the mind that actually observes mind, that is involved in mind, and that can be mind observing mind, if you will. And again, this is not something that the Prasangika Madhyamika holds to. Let me look at there's one in His Holiness's book on this verse. There's some nice commentary on page 48 if you have your book here. Maybe we'll just go through that real quickly just to see if we're understanding this, you know, correctly. So if you look at the middle of the page there, actually that on page 48, that is actually related to 16CD. The way that this book is put together, it's kind of interesting. They seem to almost always put the full verses. Occasionally they'll break it down into AB and CD, but sometimes they don't quite have things linked up together. But where it says there, the self-cognizing mind, it says the mind only may respond to this by stating that although external objects do not exist the way we perceive them as enjoying autonomous objective reality, this does not entail that they do not exist as expressions of the mind. So Chittamatra again is saying, you know, you middle way have just told me that if I'm adhering to my illusion, then, you know, to the way that this is an illusion, then that object can't possibly exist. Okay, so that's what we just went through in 16AB, was middle way basically saying, you know, if that's so, if this is really the illusion, there's no way that that object could exist because if it would have to lack inherent existence, therefore it would not exist at all. But mind only is saying, you know, we still are saying that there is this illusion of this external object, but it's an expression of the mind, is the way that His Holiness puts this. The idea being that it's arising from this same seed that's within the substance of the mind. So it's an expression, this objective expression of the mind, whereas what's observing it is more or less the subjective expression of the mind. Although they do not exist independently, they can be said to exist as mental phenomena. So Chittamatra has no problem in saying that there is still something that has inherent existence, even though it's not external to the mind. Again, it's hard to get our heads around it, how they would exactly get into, you know, qualifying that. But so this is that is a feasible defense by the mind-only school. However, it's contested by Madhyamikas in verse 17. So here they're saying, they argue that if the illusion-like or mirage-like external objects are mere extensions of the mind, as what Chittamatra is saying. So we have this expression of the mind or mere extension of the mind. There's an object out here that's really coming from the same substance as the mind, a subjective expression, an objective expression. Then in reality, they're both part of the mind. You know, you can't really deny in the end that they're both arising from something that's a substance in the mind, this imprint or bakchak within the mind. So mind only, or middle way, is not letting mind only kind of get away with this idea of establishing some sort of objective nature without admitting in the end that these are both the same substance as the mind. The expression of the object and the expression of the subject knowing it are both arising from the mind. Yeah, Janice?
The word substance is really interesting to me because it's not really, like, you've got a conscious apprehender looking at this object, mm-hmm. the object appears as a solid object.
Right.
So what's the substance?
For the...
For
yeah, yeah, yeah. It's no, I think it is a strange thing. His way of saying, like, expressions of the mind.
Manifestations.
Or, yeah. You know, but when it comes down to it, their object of refutation is that these objects are a different substance than the mind that is
right.
knowing them. So it really is hard to say. You know, when we talk about substance, yeah.
Like a conscious mind that has no, that's a formless continuum observing an object made of form.
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty bizarre.
Yeah.
So they basically, mind only, or middle way, is saying, as His Holiness says, if this is so, the mind only will be compelled to maintain that when mind perceives external objects, what is happening is that the mind is perceiving mind. So this is a consequence that Prasangika is throwing at them again. So in the end, they're saying, mind only, you got to admit that even though you're talking about an objective aspect and a subjective aspect, if they're both from the same substance, they're both mind. Therefore, mind is perceiving mind. And for Prasangika, this is a fundamental problem. How can we coherently speak of subjects and objects in a situation where, after all, there's nothing but mind itself? Okay? Let's look at our commentary that we have from Drukpa Gyaltsen and see if we can get through the rest of this as well, because there's a rather more extensive explanation on this. It says, then, if mind itself appears as an illusory object, but there is no external object, then what consciousness that is free of an object is seen by what valid cognizer at that time? There will be no seer. It is untenable that the consciousness itself experiences and cognizes itself in a manner of vanished dualistic appearances. So this is getting to kind of what a reply that would come forth from Chittamatra that's really not in the text here, which is they say, well, there is mind that knows mind. And that's relating back to what I just talked about, this self-cognizer, self-cognition. They say that there is an aspect of mind that is mind observing mind in a non-dualistic manner. So there's no sense of subject and object. There's subject knowing subject, but it's all within the same consciousness. Okay. This is actually spelled out. Those of you who have the commentary, this longer commentary that His Holiness was using when he taught, just so you know, it's on pages 153 and 154. We have a copy of this in the library, by the way, those of you who might want to take a look at it. It's quite interesting. I think it's actually very much modeled after the commentary that we're using by Drukpa Gyaltsen. So, anyway, maybe I won't go into that at the moment. I'm sorry? 153, 154. I'll just read a little bit. It says, in answer to our question, who sees and what is seen, the Chittamatrans and others who assert a self-knowing mind, what he calls here self-knowing, we call self-cognizing, give the following reply. The mind has two aspects. One that's oriented outward, that's what we call its sort of object aspect, and the other one is oriented inward. And that's oriented inward only. So the self-cognizer, it is an inward pointing consciousness. It looks at the mind. It doesn't look at external objects at all. So it's knowing mind, not knowing any other sort of object. So the former aspect, this object aspect, is the consciousness cognizing reference, and the latter aspect is the consciousness cognizing itself. And they think that this is something that exists. And, you know, there's various reasons why that we're going to get into in this refutation of this. So let's go ahead and look at sort of how Shantideva, or actually Drukpa Gyaltsen, you know, goes through some sort of refutation of this idea already. He says, the protector of the world, this is on page 227, right after it says dualistic appearances, the protector of the world also taught in the sutra requested by Crown Jewel that mind does not see mind. By positing analogies such as the blade of a sword cannot cut the blade of a sword itself. For example, just as the blade of a sword does not cut itself no matter how, similarly the mind does not see mind. Since proponents of self-cognizers accept that an aspect of the apprehender, the subject, cognizes itself, with respect to its object of cognition and the cognizer, there's not even a mere atom which dawns in dissimilar aspect, whereby they are asserted to be the same, such that not even the isolates are different. What does this mean? This means that this self-cognizing mind, because it's still, it's inwardly focused and is part of consciousness, can't really have a different aspect. It's all the same substance. Absolutely, sure. I mean, Prasangika doesn't have a problem there. If you say that self-cognizing mind exists, it has to be the same substance as the consciousness that it's knowing. Okay. So self-consciousness, or self-cognizer, and the consciousness it's knowing, the main consciousness, are the same entity. And yet we, you know, according to these schools that adhere to it, they say that they must be different isolates. We've talked about this term before. Conceptually, we can analyze it and figure out some portion of it that we can conceptually isolate, but that doesn't mean, again, that they aren't the same entity. We've talked about this in regard to emptiness, and both Madhyamika and I believe in Chittamatra would say the same thing, that we look at the emptiness of this and this conventional existence as being the same entity but different isolates. So we can never sort of get rid of one without getting rid of the other, but we can conceptually isolate the emptiness of this object versus the conventional existence of this object. In the same way, when we look at a self-cognizing mind that's knowing consciousness itself, we can talk about them and isolate them conceptually, but when it comes down to it, they have to be the same entity. Otherwise, how could consciousness know consciousness? We have to have some common, if it is a self-cognizing, an inwardly directed mind, they have to be coming from the same place, be the same entity. Again, there's some more commentary on this if you're pointing this out, just because, I mean, I went through all of these as I was studying to be able to say something intelligent, if I am saying something intelligent, about these verses. So if you want to look further on this passage, page 286 and 290 of here, of Way of Awakening, are worth taking a peek at, towards the bottom of 286, and then on 290, about two-thirds of the way down. Any questions? I realize this is pretty dense stuff so far. Chittamatra, once we get through this Chittamatra section, I think we're going to be on a little bit better ground, but this is the hardest section to get through so far, at least. So be patient. Well, I haven't read it all, to tell you the truth. I think we're going to get into lots of fun things throughout this whole text, this whole chapter, but let's read the last little bit of this then. It says, since proponents... Okay, no, I already read that part. Hence, if such self-cognizers are asserted, then one must assert that the blade of a sword cuts itself and the like, and one must assert that a valid cognizer comprehends its object of comprehension without relying, on its object of comprehension. It's a strange, strange phrase there at the end. I mean, basically, there's lots of consequences from the adherence to this view of a self-cognizer. I don't know what more to say about it. Again, we will run into it again. But any questions? Maybe we start there. Or end there. Okay. Let's go ahead to the next passage, which now what's going to happen, Chidamatra is going to basically say, well, you may have a problem with our self-cognizer, but we have some analogies, some examples that show that a self-cognizer can exist. And these are just analogies. I mean, they're not meant to be equated to it, just like, you know, when we compare, say that something is like something, we don't mean that it is that. But it gives a referent point in our sort of conventional reality to talk about how there are similar things that exist in the world, so therefore there's no problem with it existing in this way in regard to, you know, self-cognition of a consciousness. So you're going to go through two of these to begin with. These are the first one, the analogy of the butter lamp, and then the second one is the analogy of a sort of crystal glass that's placed on blue cloth and what happens in terms of the color it takes on versus something that is naturally blue, if you will. So first let's go through 18CD and 19AB. This is the objection, the sort of setting forth this analogy, and the reply. It is just like a butter lamp that perfectly illuminates the thing that is itself. A butter lamp is not an object to be illuminated because it is not obscured by darkness. So mind only, as you see in the commentary on 227, says, for example, you know, this idea of a self-cognizer knowing the main consciousness is just like a butter lamp that perfectly illuminates the two, the thing that is itself, meaning the butter lamp, and things that are others, which would be like the other things on the altar around the butter lamp. You know, so when we place a candle in a darkened space, we see that it illuminates objects, and mind only is saying it also illuminates itself. So in the way that consciousness would be like the light that is, you know, knowing the lighting the other objects, so it's knowing external objects or things that are, you know, reference of that mind, there's also light lighting itself. There's within light its own self-illumination, if you will, which again we see Middle Way has a problem with. So they say, likewise, the consciousness cognizes both itself and others. So the Middle Way proponent says, you know, your analogy is not established. So, you know, you can't even talk to me about this analogy being something that would give any justification for a self-cognizer because it can't be established. A butter lamp simply doesn't illuminate itself. Why? It's not an object to be illuminated by the butter lamp itself because it does not need to. It's already illuminated, and it is not able to illuminate itself. You know, the idea here is that it doesn't need to as well because it's not in darkness itself. So when we light a candle, for example, we're illuminating the other objects that are within darkness. Light itself is not within darkness, is it? So light does not illuminate something that is not in darkness. The whole purpose of a light is to illuminate that which is in darkness, correct? So if that is the purpose of light, light can't illuminate light because light is not in darkness. The light that's being illuminated by light is not in darkness. I know these arguments are kind of like...
It's like you need light to see the flame. You don't need light to see the flame.
Right.
It is light.
It's already light. Right. There's nothing obscured by darkness that is illuminated by light that is light because light itself is not obscured by darkness. Light is light. I know you guys are going to be using all this at your next cocktail party, you know, to entertain everyone that, you know. I'm sorry? But the light itself can't be lit. You know what I mean? It's like light, the light of the butter lamp is light or it isn't light. Right. So it's not, it's nothing that is obscured in darkness, because light itself is light. It's not, you see what I'm saying? I mean, I don't know, they're not really talking about, when they say butter lamp, they're not talking about the whole contraption, you know, like the oil and the in the cup and the wick and all of this. They're talking about the light. Light illuminating other objects, light also illuminates itself, according to their analogy. But according to Middle Way, your analogy doesn't work, because light doesn't need to be lit, because light is light. Light is not obscured by darkness. Okay? Okay, for now. In that case, if darkness also obscures both itself and others, because this is following, what they're basically doing is Middle Way is not letting it rest there. They're also kind of going further. They're saying, okay, you're saying that light, you know, is somehow obscured by darkness, that it illuminates itself. Well, then if darkness also obscures both itself and others, because if, you know, then anything can be obscured by darkness. If light can be obscured by darkness, then darkness itself can be obscured by darkness. Then this is incorrect, because darkness is not obscured by darkness. I mean, do we have a problem seeing darkness because it's obscured by darkness? I mean, no. I mean, these get to be absurd things that somehow we have to, you know, admit that Chittamatra's point of view of looking at this analogy doesn't really hold water, because their idea that light illuminates itself implies that light is obscured by darkness, and that is not so. If they say light is obscured by darkness, then anything can be obscured by darkness. Darkness can be obscured by darkness. That means we wouldn't see darkness because it's obscured by darkness. Well, that's absurd. You know, of course we're going to see darkness. Okay. So if it is, then just like a vase that is obscured by a piece of cloth, darkness will not be seen. So this is what I just said. You know, you wouldn't see darkness if it's obscured by darkness. So anyway, there's lots of these sort of little consequences that the consequence school is throwing at the mind only. Let's take a little break, and when we come back, we'll look at the analogy of the glass. So I want to read you one little additional consequence that's in this book. Again, if you do look at this book, I would really encourage you, you're certainly welcome to look at both commentaries. These are two commentaries in Chapter 9, one by Nyingma Master, who is not exclusively within Nyingma, but you know, the second one is primarily a Gelugpa point of view. So I would encourage you to read the second one. I've tried reading both, and I find actually that the Nyingma one is a little more confusing for me, and it's that same thing again. Until you sort of master one point of view, maybe it's better not to cloud it with too many others. But on page 155 at the bottom of here is another consequence. So we just talked about this consequence for a butter lamp, you know, lighting itself. If the light illuminates light, then there are these consequences of, you know, darkness being obscured by darkness and so on that we've looked at. What is mentioned in here, it says, also, if the flame needed to be lit up by anything else, okay, so if light needed to be illuminated by light, it could not be by another source of light, for if it were, the resultant lighting of one source by another would continue ad infinitum, right? Because the light that's lighting the light would need to be lit by a light that's lighting that light, which would need to be lit by a light that's lighting that light. This infinite regress idea that kind of goes out. And this is one of the main consequences that Mind Only in other treatises and things points out as a problem with the self-cognizer, is that if you say mind is knowing mind, then some mind needs to know that mind. And we're going to get into why this is needed, or why they say it's needed, shortly, in terms of the rationale, the logic for why Mind Only and these other schools say that you have to have a self-cognizer. But in terms of this consequence, they definitely point out that it doesn't make sense, you know, to say that one consciousness needs to be known, that consciousness also would need to be known. You know, you would have to continue to validate consciousnesses. Let's go on to 19 CD, the second part of 19, and the first two of 20. So we're going to just read first the mind-only argument that's put out here. This is in regard to the second analogy. There is blue like glass that relies on other for its blueness, and that which does not. Likewise, some things are seen in reliance on other, and some are even seen without reliance. So if we go to the commentary on page 227, where it says there the refutation of the analogy of glass is as follows. The mind-only proponent is saying there is blue, as in a glass, meaning like a piece of crystal or something that's placed, you know, clear glass. It's placed on something blue, like a blue cloth. It's produced through the force of the basis, white glass, or again, white is kind of a misnomer here, clear glass, relying on other, not by way of its own entityness, its own blueness. And with respect to Vaidurya, which, I don't know, I did a little research on Vaidurya, it's always translated as lapis. But there's actually a whole little treatise, if you want to read it, I don't know, I got it here, several pages that explain why they believe that Vaidurya should actually be blue beryl, if you've ever heard of beryl. B-E-R-Y-L. Or if not blue beryl, maybe even aquamarine. But basically, they don't give much justification for it being lapis. But in the Tibetan tradition, it's always been called lapis. When we talk about the medicine Buddha, we say he's, you know, medicine Buddha, king of lapis light. You know, that this maybe is somewhat of a misnomer. But anyway, it's totally aside.
Maybe there's no beryl in Tibet?
Well, yeah, it could be. And I mean, I think they were relating it specifically because of the rareness of lapis. You know, in Tibet, it actually was, you know, quite rare. Apparently, until they found some lake that had a whole lot of it. I don't know. It's very strange. I you're welcome to look at it and read it if you want. So, with respect to something like lapis, that has blueness produced by way of its own entityness, according to mind only. So this is, you know, really different. It's not relying on others in terms of its being able to be projected as blue, whereas if we put a blue crystal orb on a very, you know, deep blue velvet cloth, it itself would appear to be blue through the force of the blue of other. So this is kind of their analogy. So we got to now relate this analogy to self-cognizing mind. So the idea is that there is a mind that knows an object that is sort of kind of taking on the aspect of an object in the way that this crystal takes on the aspect of the blue, and then there is something which is blue itself, which is kind of like contained within it. So the blue of the lapis and the lapis itself are like the consciousness knowing consciousness. They're kind of both involved in the same entity. The blueness of lapis and lapis are inseparable and totally a part of each other. They're not objectively related because the blue isn't coming from anywhere else other than from the lapis itself. Okay, so that's how they're relating it to this analogy, using that analogy to explain, you know, this idea of consciousness taking on an external aspect and consciousness having its own aspect, subjective aspect. Likewise, some such as forms are seen in reliance on other cognizers, that is, consciousnesses, and since consciousness cognizes itself by itself, some are even seen without reliance on other cognizers. Okay. So, the middle way proponent responds, let's read for this the last two lines of 20 on page 225. It is not the case that the blueness in that which was not blue made itself into the nature by itself. So the refutation that middle way comes up with here is it says it follows that the analogy that you're using doesn't hold water. Why? Because the blueness of lapis or Vaidurya not being produced as blue from other causes is incorrect. Why? Because it's not the case that the blueness in that which was not produced as blue from causes made itself into the nature of blue by itself. In other words, lapis doesn't become blue through its own nature of being blue. There are other factors that cause what we call lapis to appear as blue. So this idea that something has sort of an inherent nature of blue goes against the grain of what Prasangika Madhyamika adheres to. So once again, if we can't put forward common analogies that can be accepted on a conventional basis or that even have grounding in the reality of how things exist, then it's impossible to ever establish an analogy as being valid for what they're trying to exemplify. So middle way is basically, you know, saying that you're not, this analogy doesn't work either, because the blueness within the lapis is arising from causes and conditions from something that we would consider other as well. Just in the same way that the blue that is causing the crystal to appear as blue is other than that. You get it, kind of? I mean, I don't know the history of how, like, maybe it's in the article, of how lapis is produced. But obviously, you know, things come into existence through causes and conditions. I mean, nothing exists as blue from its own side as, like, making itself blue. You know? It exists, it's blue, because there's causes and conditions that give rise to the blueness of lapis lazuli. That's what makes it lapis lazuli, is having that blueness and all the other characteristics that are part of the compositional makeup of what we consider to be lapis lazuli. You know, and if it had a green color or a yellow color or whatever and had different other, you know, factors that resulted in it, it wouldn't be considered lapis. But that blue of lapis doesn't arise from its own nature. It arises from causes and conditions in a similar way. So they're not really, in using that lapis as an example for the mind that knows itself, that is kind of contained within itself, it's not an applicable analogy. Okay. I think the butter lamp one might be easier to follow in some regard, but the way that it's put in here, actually, on page 156 is, there is no blue that has made its own blueness. And I think that's just kind of, again, the idea, is that nothing kind of makes its own nature. Its nature comes about through causes and conditions that we consider to be sort of other than that, if you will. They're part of the continuum that gives rise to it. You know. Now let's go through 21 and 22, which is this paragraph. Well, let's read the verses and then we'll go back to the commentary. So page 225 for 21, and then we'll go to the top of the page for 22. A butter lamp illuminates when it is said that consciousness knows through being known by what is it said that awareness illuminates. If it is not seen by any, whether it illuminates or does not illuminate, is like the gracefulness of the daughter of a barren woman. It is meaningless even to express it. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so let's go through, it begins with the commentary on 21. This is the paragraph at the last paragraph on page 227. First, although a butter lamp does not illuminate itself, you know, and so this is the mind only, or middle way continuing to talk, saying, you know, well, let's revisit this whole idea of the butter lamp and illumination and what's going on with awareness. Although a butter lamp does not illuminate itself, we still say conventionally that a butter lamp illuminates, right? You know, a flashlight illuminates, the lights here illuminate. They have that quality. When it is said that consciousness knows, it is not that consciousness illuminates itself. In that case, through being known by what consciousness of other substance is it said that awareness illuminates. It's inappropriate. Okay, so what this means. The basic problem that is going on here is that when we talk about a single moment of awareness or consciousness, how can we talk about that single moment being both a subject and an object? In other words, being the subject that's knowing something else and also being the object of some subjective aspect of the consciousness as well. It's like this individual moment of consciousness can't be both subject and object. And this is, again, what the let me go to, because I made a note in regard to this older commentary from His Holiness. On page 28 of this, there's some commentary about this verse. Maybe this is more complicated to share. He says, upon analysis, a prior awareness does not apprehend an awareness in the present that has not yet arisen at the time of the prior cognition. Anyway, sorry.
That sounds a little clear to me. Because it puts it in a time.
Yeah.
You know, actually, that makes, maybe I'm just weird.
Well, why don't you, Janice, what was your understanding then?
So, the moment of mind that arises in the present exists in the present moment.
Mm-hmm.
How could it cognize something that's not going to arise until the future moment? So the moment of mind that arises in the present disintegrates before the next moment of mind arises. So there's no apprehender of that future moment of mind.
Okay.
See.
But in terms of invalidating a self-cognizer, we got to relate the self-cognizer to that. So you're saying that the self-cognizer is the future moment of mind? No, it's the mind, the present moment of mind.
I think this one is saying, how can a moment of mind observe the next moment of mind? It can't, because it'll disintegrate before the next moment of mind arises. I think that's what he's getting at. The apprehender wouldn't exist at the time of these potential apprehended subject. See what he's saying?
Because the time issue, I mean, what I'm seeing more is that because in the present moment, my consciousness is caught up in an object. So let's say, again, what we're going to see is that there's this idea of like my eye consciousness knowing blue. So my eye consciousness is observing blue in the present. How can that present consciousness would be gone any time that we would initiate a new consciousness that's going to observe it? Kind of this idea of you can't coexist at the same time. I mean, that's what I was gaining from it, but
the mind split itself, right?
So it says again, upon analysis, a prior awareness does not apprehend an awareness in the present that has not yet arisen at the time of the prior cognition. A later awareness does not apprehend an awareness that has arisen and already passed. An awareness in the present cannot be both a subject and its own object. Thus, according to the system that asserts that the designated object is found upon analysis, by means of what cognition is awareness said to be clear? This is a very hard commentary to kind of get your head around, but I think he's raising this point of like where, when we talk about self-cognizing mind existing, coexisting with the mind that it's knowing, it creates some problems in terms of when these are happening and when that could possibly happen when we have a consciousness that's caught up in another object. It doesn't create enough room for there to be these two minds coexisting at the same time.
You know, but it seems like that's only because he says so.
But, yeah, I mean, but
I mean, I
if they say
there's
that
there's not enough that mind can't see itself. I mean, so much of this just seems like the context of
when you have a cognition, is there more than one subject?
There might be.
How could you have more than one subject for when we're talking about one mental continuum?
Because the concept of being self-aware.
Yeah.
You kind of.
But don't you have to direct yourself to the self in order to be self-aware? I mean,
maybe not. I mean, maybe you just.
I mean, in the way that you're talking about it. Mm-hmm. What we're going to get into, and again, maybe we'll go ahead and jump to this. It's coming in this very next section, or shortly after, is this idea that why they say that there needs to be a self-cognizer, mind-only in other schools, is that they say when we go back to what I was saying, for example, my eye consciousness knowing blue, we can recall. Or let's use something more, you know, your eye consciousness watching the opera and your ear consciousness hearing the opera or whatever. You have a experience of the object that you recall, which was the lights and the costumes and the sound and everything. But you also have an experience that you can recall of you, the subject, experiencing those things. So what these schools say is, in order to have that recollection later of both the objective experience and the subjective experience, the objective experience is validated by the subjective mind that was there at the moment knowing it. The subjective experience has to be validated by another mind that must also be coexisting at that time, that allows you to have the retention, the recollection of the subjective experience of listening to the opera, seeing the opera, etc. Okay?
Well, I can see what makes sense to the person that's making up your system.
Well, and again, I think that Prasangika is simply looking at it and saying, you know, you may want to adhere to that and hold to that, but in the end, when we really analyze, we don't find that such a thing exists. If you want to still believe in it, you know, that's your choice, but logically, according to Prasangika, it doesn't hold water. And we're going to get into some of this refutation and how Prasangika says that we are able to have a recollection of the subjective experience and the objective experience in spite of there being no self-cognition. Anyway, let's gloss over what we've been doing here and kind of move on, because no, that's where we're headed. Let's look at 22 then. We read 22. The commentary on 22 is still in that paragraph at the bottom of 227. So it says. Well, actually, you know what's interesting? There's this one little last sentence right after it says, it is said that awareness illuminates, it is inappropriate. And then it says, if it is known by another substance, then it would absurdly follow that there will be no contact. I'm not really sure that that's a correct translation. I don't have the Tibetan text, so I can't really go back and even take a look at it. But I think that that's referring to, according to what this commentary says, this idea of infinite regress. So if we say that there's consciousness at that time and awareness at that time that's known by another substance, by another consciousness, then there has to be an endless regress of consciousnesses, infinite regress of consciousnesses that are knowing each other in order to keep validating all of them. Anyway, the next part has to do with verse 22. It says, thus, when being illuminated by itself is inappropriate, and being illuminated by another is also inappropriate, if it is not known, that is, seen even by any cognizer, then even to express the difference of whether it illuminates or does not illuminate is meaningless, because the basis of difference cannot be established by all. Just like when the daughter of a barren woman does not exist, it is meaningless to describe her gracefulness. This is just kind of establishing that, you know, we can't really even talk about something that can't be proven to exist. So if we say that there is a barren woman, I mean, you know, barren from beginning, so we're not talking about somebody who becomes barren after giving birth to children, but somebody who is, you know, by nature, you know, conventionally barren from the very beginning, that we can't talk about her having a daughter or a son or anything. I mean, they might have an adopted daughter, obviously, but in terms of what this argument is saying is that this is a non-existent. So to talk about then the qualities, like the gracefulness of the daughter of a barren woman, is totally absurd, because you're talking about the qualities of something that doesn't even exist in the first place, can't even be established to exist. A barren woman exists, but the daughter of a barren woman doesn't. Therefore, any qualities of the daughter of a barren woman can't even be discussed. I mean, the first part of that is kind of looking at the fact that if we can't even establish a truly existent consciousness, then how can we speak of it illuminating or not illuminating? So in that way, what is going on in this verse in particular is that he's saying that this non-existent consciousness, that there is no truly existent consciousness that Chittamatra is holding to, we've already kind of asserted that that's not so. So your whole talking about self-cognizers and all this other stuff is like talking about aspects of a consciousness that we don't even agree exists in the first place. There is no truly existing consciousness. The way that Chittamatra perceives consciousness and talks about consciousness is fallacious from the beginning, because they hold there to be an inherently existent consciousness. So this is kind of, again, just this little commentary that's being thrown in here by Shantideva after looking at these analogies, just kind of reiterating the middle way point of view. We always get one or two of those each Wednesday, don't we? So let's go ahead and move into this whole discussion of memory and how it occurs and what the issues are. Let's start off by reading the first two lines of 23, which are mind-only's problem with the refutation of a self-cognizer. You know, so even though middle way has set forth all this stuff, mind-only is going to come down to saying, well, you know, you may say all this, but there's a problem if you don't say that there's self-cognizers. And their problem is, let's read the first two lines then. If a self-cognizer does not exist, how would a primary consciousness be remembered? So this is at the top of page 228 in your commentary. It says, if a self-cognizer does not exist, how would a primary consciousness that is the object possessor be remembered? Since it would not, if one were to be able to infer the experience through the sign of remembrance at the time of remembering, I previously saw blue, due to emphasis on the experience of remembrance, the experience of the object is established from the sign of remembering the object I saw blue. So there's two different things going on. Again, what they're saying is that there's two experiences. The very first part of that is dealing with the experience of the object. So it says you can infer the experience of the object blue through the sign of remembering I previously saw blue, because you had a consciousness that recalls seeing blue. Okay, so we don't have a problem there. Eye consciousness sees blue. That's what validates the experience of blue, so we can recall that we saw blue at a later point. The experience of the, you know, subjective side of it, which is the remembering that... Let's see how... experience of remembrance, experience of the object established in the sign of remembering the object, I saw blue, that very experience of the object is the apprehender of blue. That's where it concludes it, right where it says 391. That's the conclusion of the argument that's setting forth, you know, the experience of the object. The experience of the object possessor is established from the sign of remembering the object possessor, I saw. So what causes us to remember that there was a consciousness there seeing blue? So we've already validated how blue is recalled because we saw blue. We had the eye consciousness that was there that we can recall. I saw blue. My eye consciousness was involved in blue at that time. But we also remember that there's an subjective aspect that is involved in the seeing. How do we remember that? They believe that that's through the force of a self-cognizer. And again, the wording on this commentary is rather difficult to get the meaning of, but this is what is basically being set out here. The self-cognizer is also established by the reasoning that refutes other alternatives as to what the experiencer of the apprehender of blue is. I really didn't find any elaborations on what these other alternatives are, but there was some commentary about self-experience and other experience in this Transcendental Wisdom book that, you're welcome to take a look at, but it's really, they really don't see that there's any other way that you could say that we can have a recollection of both the object that was known and the subject knowing that object at a later point without there being something that validates those experiences. Now, this is very much based in valid cognition, in this idea that we always need to have something that sort of validates experience of objects and subjects. Now, in the middle way school, as we're going to see, they validate each other. There's an interdependent relationship between subject and object that doesn't require any other level of subjective experience to validate it. So we'll see that in the lines to come. Let's read... any questions on that before we go on? Yeah, Charmaine.
So is the sense conscious... So they're making a clear demarcation between the sense consciousnesses and the self-cognizer?
Mm-hmm. But we would also say that a mental consciousness requires a self-cognizer. Any consciousness, a subjective experience, is validated by a self-cognizer that's knowing that at that moment.
How exactly does how does that separation occur to these other consciousnesses?
Nebuchadnezzar's only job to be
It's inwardly focused. It's entirely inwardly focused. There's no external. So we don't say that the self-cognizer knows blue at all. The self-cognizer knows the consciousness
that's experiencing
blue, or experiencing red, or experiencing emptiness, or experiencing whatever. I mean, so that they think that there has to be some level of consciousness, because this is all really stemming in the mind-only school to a great degree, because of the reification of consciousness, that consciousness plays such a key role in all of our experiences. So there's another layer that they think is really absolutely essential in order to establish a recollection of consciousness aspect of any experience. The objective aspect is validated by the consciousness. The consciousness aspect has to be validated by another consciousness.
Okay. It's okay.
Okay. Let's read 23 CD. It is remembered through relation when experiencing another, like the poison of a rat. Okay. So, let's read the commentary here. This is again on 228, towards the top. Remembering the object possessor, that subjective experience, does not establish the self-cognizer. So it's like they're saying, you know, the fact that there's a recollection of the eye that's seeing blue doesn't mean that there has to be a self-cognizer. When the apprehender of blue experiences another object, blue, the remembrance of the object possessor will be generated in relation, that is, from the relationship between the object and the object possessor. I previously saw this blue. So let's just stop there before we get into this analogy. So they're simply saying that there is an interrelationship of subject and object that is existing all the time. I mean, do we ever have a subject without an object? Subject and object are totally interdependent. And their interdependence validates each other. So by recalling the objective experience, we know the subjective experience. Because subject and object don't exist without each other. We don't call it an object unless the subject is knowing it. It's not a subject unless it's knowing an object. We don't ever talk about the two independent of each other. So merely the force of knowing the object, remembering the object, causes us to remember the experience of the subject knowing the object, because that's how objects are known. There's no other objective experience other than the subjective experience of that object. There's no other, you know, thing needed to validate that, because it's all part and parcel of what we call experience. Okay, so what they use is an analogy to kind of, now again, they don't let mind only poke holes in their analogy, so we'll see if this analogy holds water. But this is a strange little analogy that I've got different explanations of it in different parts of books, and even in Chandrakirti's text there's another explanation of it. But we're going to use what's here in this commentary and see if we can make sense out of all of this, and I may need to put it on the board, but we'll do that at the beginning of the next class, because we're kind of coming to the end of this one. So let me explain this, and then we'll stop after that, and then we'll start with this analogy again next Wednesday. But so the middle way proponent is saying that there's this analogy of the poison of a rat not being experienced at the time of lethargy, or, you know, sleeping, but remembered subsequently. For example, during winter, although the rat injected the rat poison into the body when in lethargy, the lethargy is experienced, but not the poison. Okay, they use this analogy. I don't know what kind of rat this is. The idea was that it was some sort of a bear that's hibernating. This bear is hibernating in winter. It's solely caught up in its sleep. You know, it's hibernation, what they're calling here lethargy. At the same time of that lethargy, there is a injection of poison by a rat biting this sleeping bear. No experience at the time of that rat injecting the poison. I mean, that's not what it was about, because the bear was caught up in the experience of lethargy. However, upon waking in the spring, you know, even some commentaries say when there's thunder, which means, you know, when all this happens that arouses the bear from the hibernation, the bear feels the pain of the poison that's been injected in his leg or wherever he's been bitten by the rat, and recalls or has some understanding of that experience of the injection of the poison by the rat through the force of the pain. And anyway, but there's also, again, this idea. Let's go through the analogy, the points of the analogy, and how they're related to self-cognizer. Because this isn't meant to be taken, again, this is an analogy. It's not literal. We're not talking about the consciousness of the bear and it recalling these various things through the force of, you know, not needing a self-cognizer. We're really talking about some other things related to. So let's just first delineate what is what. The injection of poison. So the injection of poison by the rat and during hibernation is related to the experience of the object possessor. Okay, so Chittamatra again divided this into two experiences. There's the experience of the object and the experience of the object possessor. We can recall that I saw blue, but we also recall the blue that we saw. The object possessor. Not a problem for Prasangika either. They just say those two validate each other. So the injection of poison is the experience of the object possessor. The lethargy is the apprehended object, the object of that experience. So they're occurring at the same time. While the bear is hibernating in sleep, there's this injection of poison going on. But there's no recollection of the injection of poison or no experience of it until a later point through the force of recalling the lethargy, recalling that while he was asleep, this occurred. So let's go through the individual points as they relate to that idea, but I thought I should kind of delineate that first. So it's really kind of a strange analogy, but you have to, again, tweak it to get to this point where you understand that what they're saying with this analogy is those two things, the apprehended object and the experience of the object possessor, validate each other. You don't need to be aware of one at the time in order to recall it later, in order to have a recollection later. So the four parts of the analogy are set out here in your commentary. Part one, the injection of the poison occurring simultaneously with the lethargy is analogous to the experience of the object possessor existing simultaneously with the apprehended object. Okay? So that's why I was giving you this equation. In the injection of poison is the experience of the object possessor. The lethargy is the apprehended object, or the experience of the apprehended object. So we'll go back and maybe, you know, try to relate this again later, like I said. Point two, the object possessor not being experienced by itself at that time is analogous to the poison not being experienced at the time of the lethargy. So when we're in the opera, this is what I think Kimberly was getting at, was kind of like, you know, when we're in an experience, we're just having the experience, and, you know, we're not, you know, who's to say what else is going on? I mean, this was, I think, Kimberly's point, was maybe there is this self-cognizer mind going on, but at the time of an experience, we're caught up in the object, you know? So at the time of the injection of the poison, the bear's caught up in his sleep. You know, it's not really paying attention to that. Once we turn our mind towards the objective experience of it, we've taken a new object, I think. You know, so if you're sitting in the opera, you know, and you're listening to things and watching things, and all of a sudden you have the thought of, you know, your own joy at your own partaking of the experience of the opera, you've got a new object now. You're not taking the opera as your object, you're taking your subjective experience looking back at those moments of joy that you were having while you were caught up in the opera. Kind of? I mean, does it make sense? So again, what we're saying then with this analogy is that at the time of the experience of the object, that's what we're caught up in, the apprehended object. We're not really needing an awareness or even so involved in the awareness that is knowing the object. It's happening. It's all happening at the same time. Yeah, Kim, maybe Janice first. You had.
But when you're in the opera, you're conscious. You're of these sense objects,
sure.
the sights, the sounds, the things, the joy.
Uh-huh.
When the bear is hibernating, he's completely unconscious, right? So
well, but that's why again, his object is lethargy. Right. His object is sleep. So we're not. That's why this isn't a pure analogy in terms of looking at the bear's mind at these times.
Okay.
All we're saying is the experience of the injection of poison is similar to the experience of the object possessor. and the, because they're both happening at the same time. That's all that we're getting
right.
at. The injection of poison is happening at the same time as sleep. At the time of sleep, though, lethargy is all that's
experienced.
Yeah. Just like at the opera, we're only experiencing the opera. We can look back later and recall that, sure, there was a subjective experience of the opera, but we're in an objective experience while we're engaged in that object. When you're listening to music, you're listening to music. Later on, you know, you think, oh, how wonderful it was to, you know, to hear that symphony performed by, you know, da-da-da-da. You know, you don't, I mean, you, if you ever turn your attention towards that during the listening of it, then you're no longer listening to it. You're thinking about your experience of it, your subjective experience. And then we can later think about our thinking of that subjective experience. I mean, this is what the nature of the mind is that we can turn our mind towards any of these aspects, but to turn our mind towards the present awareness, present knowing of something, that becomes the object. There's no way that we can kind of have an object that we're knowing at the time that's other than that. Yeah, Charmaine.
So if you're at an opera and you're enjoying the object, which is the opera, and not your subjective experience, then how do you recall your subjective experience?
Merely by recalling the opera. Because your subjective experience was the consciousness that was there through the objective experience.
If you don't have that as your object at all during the opera, if you're only focused on the object, which is the opera, and not the object, which is your subjective.
Well, I'm not saying that you wouldn't.
How do you recall
but I'm not saying that you wouldn't necessarily. Well, you still would be able to recall it, absolutely.
Would you make it up? Like,
no, you don't make it up. It's dependent upon recalling the object.
Okay, because the object, which is the opera, mm-hmm. can't be separate.
That's the only way that we know opera is through the subjective experience of the opera. There's an objective experience that, again, is how we're kind of classifying these, is one that's related towards recalling the object, one that's related towards recalling the subject knowing the object. But the subject knowing the object and the object, totally interdependent. We can't ever think about one without thinking about the other at some level. I mean, we don't need to have something validating one other than the other.
So you can switch back and forth between the object and experience.
Yeah, and while you're at the opera, yeah, you're doing that all the time. You know, you're thinking, oh, this is really wonderful. I'm sitting out here enjoying this, you know, wonderful summer evening and, you know, beautiful music and da-da-da-da and whatever. You get caught up in a subjective part of it. But once you're doing that, again, you're turning your mind towards a subjective experience. Your object is no longer the notes and the costumes and whatever else is going on stage.
But I'm just saying, if you don't have a really conscious, if you don't hold your subjective experience as the object while you're at the opera, you know, like you're totally caught up in the opera, and you don't even realize it's finished, and you haven't thought, like, wow, I really enjoy this, and then you leave, then the way that we're recalling that is that you're saying that the objective experience is interrelated, cannot be separated from the subjective experience, and that's how you do the recall later, right?
Through recalling the objective experience, you have the subjective experience because there's no way to know the object without a subject being there.
I mean, I can see why they want a self-cognizer. I mean,
we'll have a vote after this and see if we still hold on to it. Let's go through the remaining points and then we'll end for the evening. So the object, that second one we went through, the third one, remembering. The lethargy, subsequently, is analogous to remembering the experience of the object. Okay? So when I ask you, you know, did you go to the opera? And you say, oh yeah, there was, you know, this wonderful costume and this great singer from, you know, Australia or whatever. I mean, you're like picking out all these points of things that you saw that were your objective experience. You know, having, you know, the experience of the lethargy is the experience of the object at a later time. Remembering the previous object possessor, although it did not experience itself through the very remembrance of the experience of the object, is analogous to remembering the previously injected poison that was not experienced through the very remembrance of the lethargy. So, the first part of that, this is what Prasangika holds. You remember the previous objective possessor through the very remembrance of the experience of the object, even though it doesn't experience itself. Even though you don't need some other level of consciousness present at the opera, you know, watching your consciousness to remember later what your consciousness had in a subjective experience of the object. You know, the object is validated through that and so on, you know, as we saw earlier. So this is analogous to remembering the previously injected poison that was not experienced through the very remembrance of the lethargy. So by recalling that the bear was asleep, he recalls that the injection of poison occurred. Again, I think you can't make these direct analogies to the mind. These are just looking at these two points and saying one is dependent upon remembering the other. So by recalling the object, you also get the subjective component. By recalling, you know, what it was like to sit in, you know, your first day of grade school, you know, by recalling the elements of that, you recall the subjective experience of it. They're totally interdependent. There's no other consciousness that's necessary at the time.
Yeah, you don't think of the subject separate.
That was knowing the subject at that time.
You just think of the experience. You know?
Exactly. I mean, this is a good point. When it comes down to our actual recollection of it, we don't recall a self-cognizing mind that was knowing that consciousness at that time that was knowing the object. We only recall the experience of the object. I mean, maybe some people have various levels of their mind where they're recalling, you know, I don't know, I don't want to get into, you know, maybe a discussion on that, but in general, there is a consciousness. That's why I was saying earlier, is it possible to think that there's two subjects, two subjects present at the same time when we're knowing one object? Or holding two objects at the same time, because that subject, if there are two subjects, would have to have an object, which is the consciousness itself. How can we hold the object blue and also hold our eye consciousness at the same time as our object? We just don't see that in our experience that we have these two levels of consciousness going on.
So the trouble is with music, though, that's not really true. I mean, there's an ecstatic experience of music where those two things do happen simultaneously.
I'm not saying that we don't have a subjective experience. We absolutely do. I mean, that's part of having an objective experience, though. I mean, I don't think that we really are isolating them. What they're looking at is this idea of having a recollection of them later, that you'd need something else to validate that other than the recollection of your sitting in the opera, you know, that experience of that objective field of all this various stuff happening in the opera is enough to validate the experience of you being there in the opera experiencing all of that. Yeah, I mean, you do have this objective experience. I'm not denying that. I mean, yeah, maybe something I said might have given that inference. It's just your subjective experience is a part of the objective experience. And they're totally interrelated. You know, you never have one without the other. So your recollection doesn't depend on anything else to validate it. Wow. This is it's a rather belabored point in this text, but I guess Shantideva felt it was really necessary to do. This paragraph, we don't need to do any commentary. Let's just go through it real quick, and then we'll end it, because this is applicable to these verses. It says, "This appears to be a marvelous reasoning of the production of remembrance in the absence of a self-cognizer that is composed by the Lord of Scholars. In response to, it follows that it is incorrect that in general a subsequent primary consciousness remembers, because that previous primary consciousness did not experience itself by itself. The reply is that the pervasion's not established." So basically they're saying you can't establish that, you know, there has to be a self-cognizer due to having a recollection later of the subjective experience. That's really not, you know, there's no pervasion there. Because there's a way to have a recollection of it that we've just exhibited through this analogy and everything, that you can recall the subjective experience and the objective experience later simply by their interdependence. "Hence, the intention of engaging in the deeds of a bodhisattva is taught to be self-cognizers are not refuted conventionally is utterly not the assertion of the great victor's child." So some people could, you know, maybe take out of this that there's still some way to validate self-cognizers conventionally. And that's absolutely not what Shantideva is saying, is all that Drukpa Gyaltsen is saying here. This is a refutation of self-cognizers conventionally. They wouldn't exist ultimately if they didn't exist, but they don't exist conventionally, period. Okay. enough. Sorry, I think I've done it again. I've like taken you all over the top. You've got stuff spilling out the sides. Let's go to the prayer book. I think everyone has a copy of this special prayer that Rinpoche has translated. This was a kind of a nice little prayer that Diogo Kensei Rinpoche wrote for his, you know, so that His Holiness's wishes would be fulfilled. So maybe what we'll do is we'll recite just on page 235, the first two verses there in English, and then we'll go to the long life prayer and we'll recite this as part of that. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel Bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish but increase more and more. Turn forward to page 244. We'll skip the nice little verses from Shantideva tonight. You can say them on your own after this if you want. And we'll recite these long life prayers. What we'll do is we'll do the long life prayer for His Holiness in English and Tibetan, then we'll recite this prayer that spontaneously fulfills all wishes, and then we'll recite Lama Zopa's long life prayer in English. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All-powerful Chenrezig Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. Gangri dawe korwe jinkam dir pendang dewa malu jungwe ne chenre zigwan tenzin gyatso yi jape sitte bardu tengur chi. Savior of the snowland teachings and transmigratory beings, who makes extremely clear the path that is unification of emptiness and compassion, to the lotus holder, Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. You who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjuna's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplish magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. We make strong prayers for the good health and long lives of these two precious teachers, as well as all teachers with whom we have a special karmic connection, so that we might never be separated from them nor from this precious Mahayana Dharma in all lifetimes until we attain the state of complete enlightenment. And lastly, we dedicate for peace, peace in the hearts and minds of each and every sentient being throughout every realm. Maybe also take a minute to rejoice on this very powerful day of Chokor Duchen. This is one in which our merit gets multiplied and increased greatly. So even our rejoicing in our ability to be here, in all the things that make this possible, all the actions of holy beings that enable us to study this Dharma, just rejoicing in all of these activities. Okay, thank you all very much.